Mr. Simon, sorry.
May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Nishay Sen, and I represent the defendant appellant Terry Thomas in this matter. Before the court are various issues that have been raised after a trial and sentencing in the district court. And to lay some background as to the issues, specifically the three main issues of insufficiency of the evidence, a fatal variance, and a constructive amendment, I want to set forth certain facts that we believe are the groundwork for those issues. First of all, Your Honors, on originally Mr. Thomas was charged in one count for possession with the intent to distribute on November 3rd of 1999. On January 30th, approximately about 15 days before trial, the government files a motion for 404B evidence, which is denied. On February 10th of the same year, they file a motion to reconsider, which is 13 days before trial. Again, at this time, the only count that's pending before the district court is a simple possession with the intent. The motion to reconsider is denied, and the government comes back with a superseding indictment, now charging two counts. The first count being a conspiracy that starts from August 1999 and proceeds to November of 1999. The second count remains identical to the original first count for possession with the intent to deliver on November 3rd, 1999. The conspiracy charge that Mr. Thomas, along with Michael Warr and Tyrone Thompson, conspired to distribute, possessed with intent to distribute narcotics between a short time frame of August 1999 to November 1999. Your Honors, when this matter went to trial and Mr. Thomas was convicted, there was insufficient evidence to convict him of count one of a single conspiracy. Now, given the fact that evidence is required that a conspiracy, that there's some structure, scope, organization, or that there is conduct that has some commonality or purpose or objective or common agreement, the evidence in this case showed four distinct and separate conspiracies. The only thing common in those four separate distinct conspiracies, or actual four separate distinct possessions with the intent to distribute, is Mr. Thomas and also the location on where these transactions took place.
Why is that not enough?
Well, Your Honor, that's four separate conspiracies. That's not one overarching conspiracy to prove that these three...
Well, it's all at the same place within a short period of time.
But there was no common
actor, your client.
Well, that's the only commonality. You look at the other two co-defendants who are charged in this conspiracy, Michael Warr and Tyrone Thompson, there is no evidence to show they had anything to do with the other three prior transactions. In fact, the evidence at trial showed that the players involved and the technique used to sell were completely different than what took place on November 3rd, 1999 that did involve the other two co-defendants. What you have is four separate distinct acts which are buy-sells.
Well, the jury could reject that theory of the evidence and accept the one proffered by the government.
Well, Judge,
the standard of review is very steep.
It is steep, Your Honor, but if you look at the facts that were presented to the jury in this case, and that raises to the fatal variance of the indictment and also our argument for constructive amendment. If you look at what the government, the evidence they put on and the argument that they then make, look at their closing argument when they say that what took place on October 22nd between Mr. Thomas and a black lady is sufficient to provide the agreement as to count one. Later then they argue, well, okay, if that's not enough, let's look at what happened on September 5th. Mr. Thomas happens to be in the same place, but again, you have other players that do not involve Michael Warr or Tyrone Thompson. Then they say that it's sufficient to look at the facts that took place simply on September 7th. Their own argument and their own evidence shows that there's no overarching conspiracy here. What took place are four separate distinct acts, and the purpose to charge this conspiracy is just clear from the procedure of this case. They were denied the ability to bring in 404B evidence in the beginning, yet they now charge a conspiracy, can bring in prior bad acts of four separate days to get at least at minimum a conviction on count two, which is the possession, which was shaky at best in the beginning. That's why they indicted brought up the conspiracy charges.
Well, we've got evidence of activities on the part of your client on four separate days over a short period of time at the exact same location, but he's doing essentially the same thing in each of these incidents. He's directing traffic in an open-air drug market on 50th Street.
I don't disagree with that.
Performing various roles, directing customers and watching out for police and hooking people up with drugs.
And, Judge, there's no disagreement that that would be an independent act of either possession with the intent or separate conspiracy with the people that were involved with that act. If you look at the setup, if you use your example on October 22nd, Mr. Thomas was in an open-air drug market, and there was other people who were not charged in this conspiracy, and there's the absence of the people who are charged in the conspiracy. There's no nexus of what took place on October 22nd to what took place on September 5th, September 7th, or November 3rd. Where's the commonality that an overarching conspiracy requires? There is none. There was no evidence presented for that. We don't disagree that you may have four separate multiple conspiracies or four separate possessions with the intent to distribute, but you don't have one overreaching conspiracy with a common goal, common purpose, common agreement, which is what basic conspiracy law requires. Where's the common agreement between Michael Warr, Mr. Thomas, and Tyrone Thompson with these other people who were involved in these other days? There's no evidence to support that whatsoever. Where's the evidence of the structure and scope that what took place on November 3rd, 1999?
What difference would it make whether he was charged with four conspiracies or one conspiracy?
There's not sufficient evidence to show one conspiracy. It's an insufficiency of the argument. The government charged Mr. Thomas with one single
You're saying he should have been charged with four separate conspiracies. How would that have made him better off?
Well, it would have made it easier for him to defend what he's being charged with.
Against four conspiracies is easier than against one?
Well, there is no one charging overreaching conspiracy in this case. If he was charged with four separate conspiracies, he would know what he's defending against. The grand jury came back with one. That's what he needed to be proven guilty of. What you have is a constructive amendment as to the charges, which allows the government to bring in all de facto 404B evidence.
Well, all four incidents were contained within the superseding indictment. Isn't that true?
No, it's not. The only thing that's contained within the superseding indictment are the dates. They allege from August 1999 to November of 1999. Nothing else contains all four of those conspiracies besides a date, which then leads to count two's conviction, where the court allowed jury instructions to basically convict him of November 3rd, 1999 by looking at what took place in September and October. I see that my time's running out, and I would like to save some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sandlin. Mr. Diamantados?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Tinos Diamantados, and I represent the appellee in this matter, the United States. Your Honors, with regards to the first issue on appeal, sufficient evidence was presented to a rational trier of fact, in this case a jury, in order to find the defendant, Mr. Terry Thomas, guilty of one overarching conspiracy. Simply put, the events that took place on September 5th, 1999, September 7th, 1999, October 22nd, 1999, and ultimately November 3rd, 1999, established that the defendant, operating in the same area, the 800 block of West 50th Place on each of those four above-mentioned dates, in a close proximity in time, relatively a two-month period, with a similar setup where he's the main key player. Each day he's dealing with different people, but essentially he's organizing the counter-surveillance. He's organizing, first of all, he's the main person marketing the drug sales by yelling out rocks and blows on these various dates. Thereafter, when customers would approach him or some of his co-conspirators, Mr. Thomas would then direct those individuals to another individual that he was working with to consummate the drug transaction. So in a sense, we've got the same location, the same defendant on all four dates, engaging in relatively the same activity. The government charged in the second superseding indictment, originally in the first superseding indictment, one conspiracy, and the dates ranging from August 1999 to November 3rd, 1999. Those four dates, September 5th through November 3rd, fall squarely within that time frame. The evidence that was presented to the jury support the conclusion that there was one conspiracy here. And again, it's because it's the same place, same defendant, predominantly the same manner of events going about on each day, and ultimately the jury was in the best position to weigh the credibility of the government's witnesses and ultimately determine if there was one conspiracy or, as Your Honor stated, reject that theory and find that the government didn't establish the allegations as to count one. With regards to defendant's argument that the closing argument somehow made it the jury able to find that if they only concluded as to an agreement onto one of these four dates, that that ultimately would mean guilt on count one. That's not accurate. Reading the closing argument in its entirety indicates that the government argued the facts that the government presented through the testimony of witnesses to establish what happened on each date. It would be absurd that the government couldn't stand up and tell the jury, look at what happened on September 5th, and go through the timeline of events as far as what the police officers did, what the defendant did, and what his named and unnamed co-conspirators did on those dates, and let the jury know via argument that here's what happened on that date, and that there was an agreement between certain parties. The government then moved forward to the following date, and again, set up the timeline of what exactly happened. So the mere fact that the closing argument was qualified by certain dates and certain discrete events that happened throughout the course of the conspiracy doesn't render this a case where there's some type of variance, let alone a fatal variance, or a constructive argument because of the fact that the government told the jury, here's what happened on all these various dates, there's one overarching conspiracy that encapsulates all of those dates, and argued to the jury that the defendant's guilty, and the jury ultimately accepted that that theory and found the defendant guilty on both counts one and two. The defendant also argues that the government somehow charged the conspiracy in an effort to backdoor in 404B evidence, that essentially the government really had a case only as to one of these dates, or in the alternative, maybe four separate smaller conspiracies, but instead the government chose to charge one overarching conspiracy in order to backdoor in all these 404B type facts. Your Honor should reject that theory, and there's multiple reasons as to why that should be rejected. First, the defendant's timeline is absolutely wrong. The government did file a motion for the court, the district court, to consider the admission of certain 404B evidence. That 404B evidence had to do with events that transpired in 1996 and 1998. Had nothing to do with anything that happened on these four dates that are in question here, and certainly no events in 1999. The district court denied the government's motion. Thereafter, the government filed returned the first superseding indictment. That's where a conspiracy count was added. Ultimately, certain facts that were developed through the course of the investigation allowed the prosecution to go before the grand jury, present that evidence, and the grand jury returned the first superseding indictment prior to the government filing a motion to the court to reconsider the 404B motion. And in its motion to reconsider, and it's part of the record, the government narrowed its focus of the 404B evidence. But again, it had nothing to do with events that transpired in 1999, and again, certainly not events that happened on September 5th, September 7th, October 22nd, or November 3rd. So the fact that Mr. Thomas is arguing that the government charged the conspiracy simply to get this in, it doesn't make sense. Your Honors, moving forward to another issue that ultimately, Your Honors, the jury was in the best position to decide whether or not the government proved the conduct as alleged in the indictment, both as to counts one and count two. There was sufficient evidence that established the defendant's guilt, that he was in fact involved in one conspiracy. Finally, the court sentence was appropriate, finding that the guideline range, or applicable advisory guideline range, was 360 months to life imprisonment, and accordingly, the defendant was appropriately sentenced to the low end of that range, which is 360 months or 30 years imprisonment. If there are no other questions, Your Honors, for the reasons set forth today in argument and the reasons we've established in our brief, we'd respectfully request that the court affirm both the jury's findings and the district court's sentence as to Mr. Thomas.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Diamantonis. Mr. Sannon, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Your Honors, even if you look at what the government just argued, it was a backdoor attempt to get 404B evidence. It may not have been the same 404B evidence, but if they would have gone to trial on the conduct of possession with the intent on November 3rd of 1999, the conduct of October and September of the same year would not have been introduced into evidence. They needed this conspiracy to bring in this de facto bad evidence to convict Mr. Thomas. And what they did in doing that is created a constructive amendment as to what was charged, especially if you take a look at what jury instructions the court gave. The jury could have convicted Mr. Thomas just based on one simple act and found that that was one overreaching conspiracy. They could have convicted Mr. Thomas on count two, the possession with the intent, just based on the simple fact that the judge says, well, the dates, it could be near or on or about, and it, constructive possession allows a conviction. That would allow for a conviction on count two without, number one, him ever being in possession of anything constructively or physically, or them looking at one of the other transactions that allegedly took place and convicting him for possession. Judge, Your Honors, what took place here, number one, was a constructive amendment to what was charged, a single overarching conspiracy using the same co-defendant, same commonality, same scheme, same agreement. There is absolutely no evidence in this record that there was an agreement between the people charged, even if you look at the people who are uncharged, because there's no common players in this matter except for Mr. Thomas. That's insufficient evidence to prove a conspiracy, even under the strictest view of a rational jury finding it. There's a fatal variance as to the indictment. There was a constructive amendment. And, Your Honors, I know I'm short on time, but we raised several other issues, including conduct of statements made in closing arguments of burden shifting. I ask that you review that and reverse the findings of the trial court and send this matter back for a new trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sannon and Mr. Diamantado.